To see better, Robert Shirky had to step around Colonel Blanchard. Pappy Henderson, Captain O.W. Henderson, then took the material to Wright Field in Ohio. He had a chance to see some of the material and described it as something very strange and like nothing he had ever seen. 2:30 p.m. Blanchard decided that it was time to go on leave. There were too many phone calls into the base asking to speak to him. He, along with a few members of the staff, drove out to the crash site. Those left at the base are told to inform the reporters that the colonel was now on leave. 3 p.m. Marcel, who had been told that he was going to Fort Worth with the wreckage, took off for the Fort Worth Army Airfield. According to Sergeant Robert Porter, one of the flight crew, there were only a few packages loaded onto the plane. One, a triangular package about 2 feet long, was wrapped in brown paper. The other three were about shoebox-sized and also wrapped. Porter said that it seemed that there was nothing in them. Johnny McBoyle, a reporter for radio station KSWS in Roswell, tried to reach the crash site. According to Merle Tucker and Lydia Sleppy, who worked at the parent station in Albuquerque, McBoyle mentioned an object that looked like a crushed dishpan and then told her to hang on. There was an argument with someone close, and then McBoyle told her to never mind. He had made a mistake. Moments later, as she was trying to get something out over the teletype, it, that is the teletype, began to type out an incoming message from the FBI. She was ordered not to complete the transmission because the item is of national security interest. Marcel was in Ramey's office with some of the debris. The general wanted to see where it had been found, and Marcel was taken to a map room. Once Ramey was satisfied, they walked back to the office, but the debris was gone. In its place was a weather balloon that had been ripped apart. Late afternoon, Brazell was back in Roswell, having helped find the second crash site. Now the military dropped the ball. No one told him to stay close, so Brazell left. Walt Whitmore found him in Roswell and took him to the radio station KGFL. Whitmore and another reporter interviewed Brazell using the wire recorder. Remember those? Most of you are not old enough. On it, Brazell told them the whole story. Whitmore then took Brazell to his house to keep him out of the hands of the military. In Fort Worth, reporter J. Bond Johnson of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram was told to drive to the base. His editor said that they had a flying saucer coming in from Roswell, and he wanted Johnson out there to cover the story. Johnson arrived at the Fort Worth Air Base and was told to head straight up to Ramey's office for the interview. On the floor were the remains of a weather balloon. Part of the rubber in it had burned, and Johnson was surprised that Ramey would keep it in his office. Johnson took 4 pictures of Ramey and the wreckage and then headed back to his office. We showed you some of those pictures in a previous half hour. More people arrived at the crash site, and they were cleaning it up. Men with wheelbarrows were moving across the field. This was a busy day. Men with wheelbarrows were moving across the field, throwing the debris in. When filled, they took the debris to collection points. The debris was then loaded into covered trucks to be driven into Roswell. Warrant Officer Irving Newton was ordered from the weather station to Ramey's office. Newton, in front of a small number of reporters and officers of the 8th Air Force, identified the wreckage on the office floor as a Rowan target balloon. He was photographed and then sent back to his regular duties. Ramey, with the identity of the wreckage thus established, announced to the world that the officers at Roswell were fooled by a weather balloon. Ramey also appeared on local radio station WBAP. And the government wants to check on the morality of churches. Blanchard and members of his staff arrived at the ranch and were taken to the second crash site where the bodies were located. The bodies were loaded into the back of a truck and then covered by a tarp. In Roswell, the base hospital began to call a local mortuary, asking questions about the preservation of tissue and what specific chemicals would do to the tissue. The mortician, Glenn Dennis, reported he received 4 or 5 such phone calls about it and decided there had been a fatal crash at the base. Lewis S. Rickett said an unscheduled flight from Bowling Field, Washington, D.C. arrived. He gave the crew a sealed box with wreckage in it. Melvin E. Brown, a member of Squadron K, 509th Bomb Group, was told to climb into the back of a truck at the second crash site. He was told not to look under the tarp, but the moment everyone's back was turned, he did. Under the tarp were the bodies of the alien flight crew. Brown said that they were small, with large heads, and that he thought the skin was yellow or orange. The bodies arrived at the base and were taken to the hospital for examination. Dr. Jesse Johnson pronounced them dead and did the preliminary work on them. The mortician, Glenn Dennis, still believing there had been a fatal crash on the base, drove out. The MP on the gate, recognizing him, waved him through and he drove to the hospital. There he entered and was met by an Army nurse. She told him to get out before he got himself into trouble. 2 MPs spotted him and bodily threw him out of the hospital. A guard at the gate reported that a truck carrying dry ice entered late in the evening. He was surprised by the late hour of the delivery. A check of the local ice house revealed no records available for the 1940s. Yeah. The bodies were sealed into a long crate, 15 feet by 3 feet by 4 feet, and the crate was moved to a hangar. It was left there, with the dry ice, I guess. With spotlights playing on it while MPs stood guard, they never approached it. Brown was given the task of guarding the outside of the hangar. Brown's commanding officer approached and said, "Come on, Brownie, let's have a look inside." But there was nothing to see then, because everything had been packed and crated and was ready for shipment out of there. Wednesday, July 9th, 1947. Morning newspapers were carrying the story that the flying saucer found in Roswell was a weather device. Some quoted Ramey, while others quoted sources, including senators in Washington. Brazel was still in Roswell, but still in the company of Walt Whitmore. Whitmore was trying to protect his exclusive interview with Brazel. Cleanup at the ranch resumed with sunup. The military was trying to get everything packed up before any more civilians stumbled across it. Robert Smith of the 1st Air Transport Unit said that they began loading crates into C-54s about 8 o'clock in the morning. The problem wasn't the weight, but the size of the crates. They felt as if they were empty. They loaded three aircraft, all destined to Kirtland and then on to Los Alamos. According to Roswell Army Airfield Head Secretary Elizabeth Kyle, the telephones at the base were still tied up by the incoming calls from around the world. The military found Brazil again and this time took steps to ensure that he didn't get away from them. They interrogated him at the base, asking him the same questions over and over again. More of the wreckage was brought into the base and was now being taken to a different location where it was boxed into crates of various sizes and shapes. The crates were built at Roswell and conformed to the standards used to ship other cargo. Bud Payne, a rancher in the Corona area, was chasing a stray cow. As he crossed onto the Foster Ranch, a jeep carrying soldiers roared over a ridgeline bearing down on him. He was carried from the Foster Ranch. Brazil was taken into town. You want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
Reading from the book UFO Crash at Roswell, Kevin D. Randall, Donald R. Smith. I understand one of the newspapers in New Mexico reviewed this book a few weeks ago. It usually happens when we go into an area. The bookstores sell out, and the newspaper people who will not admit they watch or listen will start writing reviews. I'm in that section of the book after their long anecdotal records of the research and the interviews up to and including the early 1990s. They have constructed a timeline based upon the interviews. We have proceeded along that timeline until Wednesday, July 9th, 1947. Second crash site has been found. The first crash site was found on the 4th of July weekend. Bodies reported at this second crash site. We're Wednesday, July 9th, 1947. Brazil, the farmer who found the first site, guided him to find the second, was taken into town into the officers of the Roswell Daily Record. There he gave reporters, including Jason Callahan and R.A. Adair from Albuquerque, a new story. He told them that he had found the balloon on June 14th and hadn't taken it into Roswell until 3 weeks later because he had no phone, no radio, and didn't know the world was looking for flying discs. Brazil, in that article, however, said that he had found weather balloons on other occasions, and what he had found this time was no weather balloon. Ramey's weather officer, Newton, claimed that the weather balloon was a special kind and said, "We use them because they go much higher than the eye can see." Floyd Proctor and Lyman Strickland were in Roswell and saw Mac Brazil. He was being escorted around by three military men. He ignored both Proctor and Strickland, something that he wouldn't normally have done. Whitmore at radio station KGFL got a phone call from Washington telling him not to air the interview with Brazil. According to Judd Roberts, if we played the interview, we could expect to lose our FCC license the next day. According to Art McQuitty, an officer from the base swept through Roswell picking up copies of Hout's press release. Frank Joyce confirmed it, saying that someone had searched the offices of KGFL. The military searched all the radio stations and the newspapers, taking anything that related to the story. At noon, the crate that had been sitting in the empty hangar guarded by the MPs was moved out to the bomb pit number one. According to the men who were there, nothing other than weapons was ever stored in the bomb pit. Late in the afternoon, a flight crew at the Skeet Range was told they had a special flight coming in. The Squadron Operations Officer Major Edgar Skelly told the aircraft commander to keep everyone together. Three C-54s from the 1st Air Transport Unit took off on short flights to Los Alamos. All three aircraft were loaded with crates holding the wreckage, and all the crates were marked with stencils saying, "Top Secret." It was a weather balloon, and they're showing it in the office of General Matt Ramey. Why the secrecy? Armed guards watched the loading of the aircraft. Smith was sure the crates held debris because he was shown a small piece of foil that could be wadded and then would straighten itself out. The flight crew pulled from the Skeet Range was told to quickly pre-flight their aircraft. Once that was done, and they had the engines running, they taxied out to the bomb pit. According to one of the crewmen on that flight, the only places on the base where the bomb pit could be observed were the tower and portions of the flight line. A sealed, wooden, unmarked crate was brought out and loaded into the bomb bay of B-29 tail number 7301. It was guarded by six MPs, an officer, two NCOs, and three enlisted men, all armed. They never let the crate out of their sight. At Fort Worth, the aircraft was met by a number of officers, including a mortician. Am I boring you? The bombardier recognized the man because he had gone to school with him. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been known he was a mortician. The crate was unloaded, and the flight crew was told to head back to Roswell. There was no debriefing given to them at Fort Worth. According to one of the crewmen and confirmed by Robert Slusher, Marcel returned with them on that flight. He was in Fort Worth for about 24 hours, and that had kept him out of the reporter's line of fire until the cover story could be put in place. Frank Joyce reported that officers brought Mac Brazell to radio station KGFL to be interviewed. This time, Brazell had a new story, one that was significantly different than the one he had told on Sunday. Joyce pointed that out, and Brazell responded that it would be hard or go hard on him if he didn't tell the new story. By 8 p.m., the flight crew was back. Again, they were not debriefed, but were told that they had flown the general's furniture to Fort Worth. Of course, you know, it's normal to load furniture in crates and store it in a bomb pit. I wonder what kind of furniture that was. They were cautioned not to tell anyone what they had done, including their families. The flight had not taken place. Upon his return, Marcel headed to the counterintelligence office and confronted the officer there. Marcel wanted to see the reports that had been filed in his absence, but the CIC officer refused. Marcel pointed out that he was the senior officer, but the CIC agent claimed his orders were from Washington and said, "Take it up with them." John Tiffany Sr., a crew chief assigned to Wright Field, flew on a special mission to the south. They picked up debris that none of them could identify and a huge thermos-like jug. Tiffany told family members about the bodies, his descriptions matching those of the other witnesses. The Las Vegas Review-Journal carried a story quoting a UP report that said, quote, "Reports of flying saucers whizzing through the sky fell off sharply today as the Army and Navy began a concentrated campaign to stop the rumors." The story also said that AAF headquarters in Washington received a blistering rebuke, or rather delivered a blistering rebuke to officers at Roswell. The same article was printed in other newspapers around the country. Thursday, July 10th, 1947. Bill Brazell, reading the morning paper, learned about his father's activities at Roswell. He realized that no one would be at the ranch and made plans to get down there to help. At both crash sites, the men were working to get everything cleaned up. They wanted no bit of wreckage left and no signs that there were any there. Mac Brazell was being held in the guest house on the base. The officers there were still trying to convince him that he was not to say anything about what he had seen. They were also trying to keep him out of the way of reporters still searching for a story. He was given a physical by doctors at the base hospital. There were rumors flying around Roswell about the event. People began to hear that there were bodies, and there was even talk that one of them was alive when the military got there. Major W.D. Pritchard from Alamogordo claimed that there had been a unit from his base in Roswell launching balloons around June 14th. That was undoubtedly what Brazell found. There's a caller from Roswell, Channel 2. My mother worked at the newspaper at the time, and according to what I was told and grew up hearing about, that what Mr. Brazell found when he found the aliens was that three of the aliens were already dead, one was dying, and one was still alive at the time. I grew up with this stuff. That's all we ever talked about while I was growing up. It gives me her name. Friday, July 11th, 1947. The debriefing of all the participants was underway. According to Frank Kaufman, they were taken into a room in small groups and told that the recovery was a highly classified event. No one was to talk about it to anyone. They were to forget that it ever had happened. Saturday, July 12th. 1947. Bill Brazell, son of Mac Brazell, and his wife Shirley arrived at the ranch, but there was no one around. Brazell began to work, first surveying the ranch to see what needed to be done. He saw no evidence that the military was still around. The trucks, people, and the cordon were gone. On this weekend, there were no aircraft with gun cameras searching for flying discs. There were no aircraft on standby waiting for orders to take off. In fact, there were reports that an order went out grounding all aircraft to keep them out of the sky and the search. Tuesday, July 15, 1947. Bill Brazell reported that his dad returned from Roswell. He would not say much, except that they kept asking him the same questions over and over again, and to say that Bill Brazell was better off not knowing what had happened. Besides, Mac Brazell took an oath that said he would never reveal in detail what he had seen. But now most of the world had forgotten that a flying saucer had been reported to have crashed in New Mexico. Late July 1947. Mac Brazell visited the Lyman Stricklands and told them what had gone on in Roswell. Marion Strickland said that Mac was upset over being in jail and the shabby way he'd been treated by the military. He sat in the kitchen at the table drinking coffee as he complained about the military. He would say nothing about what he had found other than he had been sworn to secrecy. August 1947. Mac Brazell, and ranch hand Tommy Tyree spotted a piece of wreckage floating in the water at the bottom of a sinkhole. Neither man bothered to climb down to retrieve it. September 1947. Lewis S. Rickett was assigned to assist Dr. Lincoln LaPaz from the University of New Mexico. LaPaz's three-week assignment was to determine, if possible, the speed and trajectory of the craft when it hit. According to Rickett, they discovered a touchdown point 5 miles from the debris field where the sand was crystallized, apparently from the heat, and they discovered more of the foil-like material. Given all that, LaPaz, not knowing that bodies had been recovered, was convinced that it had been an unoccupied probe from another planet. September 1948, 1 year later. The same Lewis S. Rickett, while in Albuquerque, met with the same Dr. Lincoln LaPaz. According to Rickett, LaPaz told him that he, LaPaz, was still convinced that what they had found was an unoccupied probe from another planet. In the year that had passed, LaPaz, in his secret dealings with various government projects, had found nothing to cause him to change his mind. October 1948, same year. The same Lewis S. Rickett met with John Wirth, another counterintelligence man. Rickett asked Wirth about the status of the material recovered at Roswell and was told that they had yet to figure it out. According to Wirth, they hadn't been able to cut it. Summer 1949, almost a year later. Bill Brazell, son of Mac Brazell, the original finder, in the 2 years following the crash, found scraps of the craft. His dad confirmed it, saying, "That looks like some of the contraption I found." Brazell in Corona mentioned that he had found some of the pieces. According to him, the next day, Captain Armstrong and three others from the Roswell base arrived and asked for the material. Armstrong reminded Brazell that his dad had cooperated with them. It was Brazell's patriotic duty to give it up. Brazell couldn't think of a good reason to deny it to them and surrendered it. ...1961, 12 years later. UPI stringer Jay West reported that he was working in Alamogordo in the area of the White Sands Proving Ground when he became friendly with the base public information officer. The PIO, or public information officer, had found a file that mentioned the Roswell crash that included a map. The PIO got a topographical map of the crash site. According to West, they made trips out to try to locate the crash. West described the map as showing the debris field and then 2.5 miles to the east, a second crash site. 1978. 17 years later, Pappy Henderson, one of the pilots, confided in his close friend, John Cromshoulder, that he flew wreckage from a crashed saucer from Roswell, New Mexico, to Dayton, Ohio. He showed Cromshoulder a fragment of the debris and told his friend that he had seen the bodies. Jesse Marcel was located by researcher Stan Friedman. Marcel told Friedman that he was sure that the debris was nothing from Earth. Later, Marcel granted interviews to various news organizations, but those reports did not gain wide dissemination. Bob Pratt, May 1979. Bob Pratt interviewed Jesse Marcel and published an article in which Marcel admitted that he was the intelligence officer who had recovered the parts of a flying saucer. 1980. In Search Of aired a program about UFO cover-ups and interviewed Marcel. In the course of that interview, Marcel again said that whatever was found, he was sure that it was nothing from Earth, in spite of the earlier pictures with weather balloons. Want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
Well, that depends on the number of calls I get as the music plays. There's a lot more here.